Good morning. How's everyone? So I must have clicked on the wrong link. I clicked on the link for last Saturday. I thought it was clever because I saw Saturday and Sunday, but it was the last Saturday. So good to see you. Those of you who are here, let me close some of these other things here. Okay. So, still a couple of people still to come, I suppose. But let's begin as we have been doing with a little meditation. So, sit comfortably. Relax your body. Relax your mind. Another way of understanding relax your mind is just to recall everything is empty of inherent existence. All the things that appear to us as so real and important are actually devoid of that reality, that importance. As I said before, there's nothing else you have to think about right now. So see if you can very carefully watch your respiration for 7 rounds, not fast, just observing it, the whole extent in, when it's turning, out, when it's turning, and so forth. And then bring your attention to your mind, your mental consciousness. One way of facilitating that is to imagine the next breath coming up your 2 nostrils to the crown of your head, down to your heart chakra, where there's the subtlemost mind residing. Leave your attention there and just watch the contents of your mind. Those of you who were at the previous seminar and the other talks may have already developed a little mental image of that spaciousness of the mind, which you can bring into the present now, is what we call a remembering consciousness. It's sort of starting out. Like when you've done yoga again and again, the muscles are a little bit stretched. You can get into postures more quickly. Recall that the clear light nature of the mind that we're exploring here is something that's observed with the mental consciousness, with what is called the eye of wisdom. Not the physical eye that's based on the gross matter of the eyeball. Even when thoughts and images, opinions and feelings and so forth are present in the mind, simply recognizing that their presence indicates that the mind must be unobstructing, must be clear, open. Defocusing on the objective thoughts that are within the mind and refocusing on the spaciousness that surrounds them, within which they are arising. If the sense of your body so seemingly present, looming there, distracts you, recognize it is being apprehended by your mental consciousness as an appearance to the mind. Place your attention on the spaciousness of the mind within which it's arising. And the elusive self, the sense that you are meditating, if that's apparent to your mind, let go of that also. Sense the spaciousness of the mind within which that's arising. Even your imagination or visualization of the clear light nature, is it yet just an approximation within the actual clear light nature of your mind? Let go of that approximation and try to sense the actual clarity pervading everything, pervading everywhere. This conventional nature of the mind can be called our conventional Buddha potential, Buddha nature. We're not Buddhas yet, but within this mind we can develop the good qualities of the Bodhisattva path leading to enlightenment. We can eliminate all of the discordant factors, our delusions, our afflictions. The fact that we can recognize it right now is a result of having been born as a human, heard the teachings of Buddha, having faith in them and so forth, and what we call a life of leisure and endowment. I think the best way to make use of this life is to put effort in developing the realizations, the essential realizations of the path. Real renunciation of all of cyclic existence. The mind that wishes to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, out of compassion for them, we call bodhicitta. And the wisdom that recognizes the ultimate nature of phenomena, the wisdom of emptiness, which is the subject matter of the Heart Sutra. So with the purpose, with the aim, or motivation of listening, participating in this session today and the rest of the weekend to make these realizations, especially to understand better emptiness, to have an insight into it. I'm going to listen carefully, knowing that in so doing, I'll make myself more capable of helping others. When there's chaos around us, chaos, I may be able to be like the middle of the tornado, the eye at the middle of the tornado. Everything else is going crazy around us, and we can remain as an inspiration to others to give guidance. I'm going to listen and participate today in order to quickly achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And then relax. Bring your attention back to the present. How are you doing? Okay. Good to see you. How many people we have here? Oh, we have more people than we had last night. Okay. So let me ask if you have any questions left over from yesterday.
Venerable George, a student did send me a couple of questions to ask you.
Okay.
The questions are an Arya and an Arhat the same thing?
Are an Arya being and an Arhat the same thing? So no, they're not the same thing. If one is an Arhat, one is an Arya. But if one is an Arya, one is not necessarily an Arhat. Okay, what does that mean? An Arya being is someone who's realized emptiness barely, nakedly. We say directly. That means they know, although they might still have conceptual understanding of it, they have gone beyond that, and in certain circumstances, they have perceived it without any thought processes in the way that we see with our eye, nakedly, direct perception. And in so doing, they have, at that point, they have achieved cessation of certain of the kleshas, certain of the delusions, so that they'll never come back again. And as they continue to meditate, like in the Heart Sutra, it says, correctly and repeatedly viewing the five aggregates as empty of inherent nature also, as they do that, they progress from the path of seeing, that's the point at which they've realized emptiness directly, when they become an Arya, and they enter into a longer period of what's called the path of meditation or familiarization, where they meditate on emptiness again and again, successively taking out, like the example I gave yesterday from the turkey pan at Thanksgiving, first with your hand, maybe you take out the gross stuff that's stuck there, and then you use a plastic thing to get a little deeper, and eventually maybe the Scott Bright pad, and then water, and then some cleaner, some you know, different things. Finally, you rinse it out with water, you get out all the stuff. So successively, as they get out more and more of the afflictions, at a certain point, all of the afflictions, all of the klesha have been ceased, so they'll never return again. And at that point, one could be called an arhat. The etymology that the Tibetans take from the Sanskrit shastras, the treatises, is that Arhat is an individual who has destroyed the foe of the afflictions, a foe destroyer. That's how it's sometimes translated, enemy destroyer. So it doesn't mean the external enemies. It means the foes or enemies within your own mind. If one is an arhat, that's the immediate goal of the Hinayana path. One has attained what's called a nirvana at that point. That nirvana, while you're still alive, is called nirvana with remainder, meaning you still have the aggregates, the body and mental factors that were originally contaminated, that were sort of samsaric. So you have a remainder of those. And when you finally die in that lifetime, having achieved nirvana, having become an arhat, as the goal of the Hinayana path, your mind leaves this body. And some interpretations in the Hinayana path say that means the mind just ceases and no longer takes rebirth. But the Mahayana understanding is that individual's mind stream still exists in deep concentration on emptiness and will remain for eons in that state, not being able to help sentient beings until one is awakened by the Buddhas and one enters into taking rebirth again, not due to one's bad karma, but by choice, by prayers and so forth. So on the Mahayana path, the point in which you become a Mahayana arhat is on the eighth bhumi. You have not yet achieved enlightenment, but you've gotten rid of all of the delusions. And at that point, according to the highest philosophical school, you start to eliminate the final subtle obstructions to omniscience, which prevent you from seeing all phenomena simultaneously, both levels of truth, conventional truth and ultimate truth at the same time, the state in which you can effortlessly and spontaneously help sentient beings without thought process, not thinking, oh, Robbie needs to be reminded of this, or, you know, so-and-so needs this or that, I've got to do that. They happen spontaneously due to one's previous, you know, great familiarity with compassion and working for the benefit of sentient beings. So an Arya being is not necessarily an arhat. They could be anywhere on that path between having first eliminated the first illusion up until arhatship. If one is an arhat, one is necessarily an Arya, because Arya means you've realized emptiness directly. Is that okay? That clarifies. I don't know if the person who asked it, was it Stephanie who asked that question? Okay, so that's it. So let's see, second question to Stephanie, does anyone else have a question? Or observation or correction, if I've made some mistake? Okay. We'll take one more if there's another question, Donna, Stephanie's.
Yes. The next question is, Avalokiteshvara says, the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom. What is meant to be that activity?
So at that time when the Buddha was in concentration, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom. So what is the question of Shariputra was, how do the Bodhisattvas train in the practice of the perfection of wisdom? And initially Avalokiteshvara is actually thinking about with a conceptual mind. He's not in actual direct perception of emptiness, he has left that equipoise, we call the concentration where you have space-like visual understanding of emptiness. He has a remembering consciousness of that, and he's analyzing that. He's thinking how the bodhisattvas practice the perfection of wisdom. Why is he thinking that at that time? Why does that happen to be in his mind then? Due to the inspiration of the Buddha, the Buddha's concentration, with the Buddha's, intention that this come about, that Avalokiteshvara will be thinking about that. Shariputra will ask a question, how the bodhisattvas train in that. And then Avalokiteshvara will explain, not just for Shariputra, but for everyone, how that happens. So that means he's in a meditative state, but that doesn't mean equipoise. Equipoise means when your senses are absorbed, only your mental consciousness is active, and there's different kinds of equipoise. You can have a conceptual understanding of emptiness or direct realization of emptiness, but he has previously had a direct realization of emptiness. So now he's with the memory of that, with the understanding of that, was called subsequent attainment. When you arise from that, and although phenomena appear to you again and your own self-identity appears, and it looks like it's inherently existent, you kind of sketches, oh my gosh, it's so amazing. You know, it looks so real, but I know it's not. That kind of insight is what is, you know, is happening here. And Avalokiteshvara is thinking how the bodhisattvas train in that, how they would enter into meditation, the logics they use, which is the basis for his his answers, his coming answers. Okay. So if there's more, we'll wait till a break to go more from Stephanie. But that's a good start. What I wanted to, I couldn't find the quotation yesterday. I wanted to remember. I said that the Hinayana practitioners, the practitioners of the lesser vehicle, which is a terminology the Buddha himself used. I mentioned it before, maybe in one of the other courses. In Asia, sometimes the word Hinayana is considered to be pejorative. Like today, being politically correct, there's certain things you can't say, right? So some people would say, you can't call the Theravada tradition the Hinayana, the H word. whereas in the Mahayana Sutras, the Buddha himself said, not criticizing his own teachings, because he taught his Hinayana. He says, those of sharp intellect and courage, and compassion, should not be satisfied with my Hinayana, with my vehicle, the lesser vehicle that brings you to that lesser goal of nirvana, but they should strive for the Mahayana. So in some of the Buddhist schools, it's believed that the practitioners of the Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, don't realize fully fledged emptiness. They realize just the selflessness of the person, like we were discussing yesterday. But it's mentioned that there are teachings in the sutras, the suttas. We say the Pali Canon in Pali is, instead of saying sutra, you say sutta. You know, my corny joke all the time. I now realize, having spoken a bit about Buddhism for some time, that my teacher Geshe Sopa, who always had these same kind of jokes he'd mention every time he taught a subject, when he talked about exalted wisdom, which you could also call gnosis. You know the word gnosis? G-N-O-S-I-S. Geshe would say, I say gnosis, not noses. So here I'm going to say, my corny joke is that speaking Pali is a little bit like John Kennedy trying to pronounce Sanskrit, you know, John Kennedy with Pak, the Ka, and the Ha, the Yod. Some of the conjunct consonants are not there. So instead of saying sutra, where there's a T followed by an R, one in Pali is more easy to pronounce sutta. So in the Pali Suttas, there is something like this. The form aggregate is like a ball of foam. It cannot withstand being held and separated. So we're talking about the five aggregates, the form aggregate. The feeling aggregate is like water, is like a water bubble, because it is momentary, impermanent. Feelings, you know, are not there continuously, even though they might seem that way sometimes. The aggregate of discrimination is like a mirage, because it mistakenly apprehends, because it is mistakenly apprehended by the thirst of attachment. The aggregate of compositional factors is like a stalk, like the stalk of a lotus, or in other renditions of that particular line, is like a plantain tree, because when it is destroyed, it has no core. So, like certain kind of plants, if you know, it has leaves, like an artichoke, you know, keep on taking the leaves off. There is a heart at the end of that, but a plantain tree, when you take away the leaves, there's no heart there. There's no essence. The aggregate of consciousness is like a dream, because it is mistakenly conceived. So in Donald Lopez's book, which is if you want to go into detail about these things, can you read that? The Heart Sutra Explained, Indian and Tibetan Commentaries by Donald Lopez, goes into a lot of seemingly contradictory things and never really clarifies which is the preferred version, but anyway, it's a good resource. He mentions in the note to that the comparison of the five aggregates with the ball of foam and so forth appears in the Samyukta Nikaya, which is one of the Hinayana scriptures. One finds reference to that in many of the Mahayana sutras, when they say that the Hinayana practitioners, the hearers and solitary realizers, do realize emptiness, even though their main, fully qualified emptiness, even though at the beginning their main goal is to recognize that the person is empty of being a self-supporting, substantially existent person. Mainly they're realizing subtle impermanence, and so there's no permanent person. One of our fellow Sangha, Dengelik, is actually Australian guy, Max Redlick. Does anyone know Max? Maybe Robbie knows. No. Max had been, his father owned a big meat factory, what would you say, slaughterhouse in like Tyson Chicken or something like that, in Australia, and when he was exposed to Buddhism, he decided to become a monk to make amends for all the killing that he had ordered, you know, as he took over the business. And he went to a Theravada course at a monastery in Burma, in the country of Burma, what was now Myanmar, right? And they were talking about meditating on selflessness. The main object for them was trying to realize subtle impermanence, because for them, the main sense of I was some kind of permanent I, like the Atma of the Hindu tradition, sort of something that's always there, unchanging. Whereas in the, so that might be for a lot of Hinayana practitioners, how they first enter into meditating on selflessness of persons. Later they'll understand that there's a subtler version of the person that's not just permanent, seemingly permanent, but one which is, seems to be, what's called substantially existent. Not quite inherently existent, but they don't see that subtlety yet. And then eventually they can understand that the object to be negated in selflessness is this sense of an inherently existent person on the basis of quotations in their suttas, such as in the Samyutta Nikaya and some of the other sutras. Suttas or sutras, depending on how you like to translate it. So I wanted to mention that to fill in that. So now we've come to the point in the sutra, in the Heart Sutra, where we've talked about the fourfold profundity, right? Shariputra, any son or of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom. In other words, they want to know how to meditate on emptiness in answer to a particular to Stephanie's question. They should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So how can you behold something as empty of inherent nature? First, you have to, from the present Gika point of view, the highest philosophical school, especially in the Galupa tradition, it said that you don't just simply let go of it and say, oh, it doesn't exist. You first have to observe this object of negation in its subtlety, not just an eye that seems permanent, not just an eye that seems to be the owner of your body and mind, although that's a little bit subtler, not just an eye that seems to be substantially existent, self-supporting, existing there by itself, but an eye that seems to be inherently existent, existing without dependence on anything else. You have to observe that. How do you negate that? It's not just you say, oh, it doesn't exist without any reason. You have to use reasoning to do that. And here, a little bit of the reasoning is talking about the two levels of truth. Correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. This is what is these four enigmatic statements. Sometimes when people talk about the Heart Sutra, that's all they know of, the statement, right? Form is actually in some of the renditions of the sutra, it says form is emptiness. The way that I've translated here is in the Galupa tradition, generally we say form is empty. Emptiness is form. Whereas in some, it says both, it uses the word empty both times. Form is empty. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. So what's the difference there? The first statement, form is empty, we'll take that one first, okay? What that means is that the form that you're imagining as inherently existing, not necessarily talking about the person here, we're talking about other phenomena other than the person him or herself. The form that appears to be inherently existent is actually devoid of that reality that seems to be there, in the sense of a of a reflection appearing to be an actual, let's say, person. Or an echo is devoid of, in the source of that echo is, we think is another person over there, when it's actually, it's just a reflection off of something. You know, the example I gave in one of the other courses, when I used to say my mantras at Deer Park late at night, there was a dog that would, I was used to chasing the cars. You know how dogs like to do that. So even at late at night, even though his or her legs had been run over by a car, it had to drag the legs on the ground, it would bark and try to chase me as I was walking. And as it barked over here, I would hear another dog over there, I'm pointing over there, bark right after him, and then another dog in another direction, bark. Always the same sequence. He or she would bark, then that dog would bark, that dog would bark. After a while, the consistency of that made me a little bit suspicious, and I realized that there was no, you know, the first dog I could see, that was barking, but the other barks I heard were actually echoes off of some mounds or buildings or something in these two different directions. What I had originally thought of as being, caused, you know, like the direct sound of dogs in these two different directions, they were devoid of that reality that I had been grasping to, that I had been assenting to. You know, I'd been going along with in my mind. It seemed that way. It seemed like there was someone over there, but it's actually not there. So in the same way, form is empty means the appearance of form as being inherently existent is devoid of that reality. It's actually, although it appears, it doesn't exist the way that it appears. The same way as a reflection or a mirage or a dream, right? Form is empty. Now, when we say form is empty, that state of being empty is called emptiness, right? When you realize that form is empty of inherent existence, you have realized emptiness, the state of being empty. And the second line, form is empty, emptiness is form. One way of understanding that is to say that the emptiness that has been apprehended when you realize that form is empty, that is of the same nature as the form. What does that mean? Well, two things can be different, but still be the same nature. Like, what's a classic example? Lapis lazuli, stone, jewel, has a color of blue. So you can talk about the lapis lazuli and the color of the lapis lazuli. Are they different? Are they of different natures? Can you separate the blue from lapis lazuli? Well, what do you think? You might say, oh, you can take, if you're a scientist, you can beam a laser in there and destroy the chromium ions or whatever the ones are that are causing that color. But then it's no longer called lapis lazuli, right? It's the very nature. The blue and the lapis lazuli itself are one nature, the same entity. They're different, the color and the lapis lazuli. Say there's a table in front of me here. You can't see it. It's sort of tan, brownish tan. Actually, I think this is stained. But if you talk about a kind of wood that has a natural color, unstained, the color of that table and the table itself are of one nature. You can't destroy the color without destroying the table. You can't destroy the table without destroying the color. You can't, like lapis lazuli, you can't just break a piece of lapis lazuli with a hammer and that the blue or the turquoise color would still remain there. Right? So things can be different, but still have this, be of the same nature as one another. So form is empty. Emptiness is form. Means that form itself is devoid of any kind of an inherent existence, and the realization that what is appearing to your mind, that the mere negation of inherent existence, you're not seeing the form any longer. All you're perceiving is a vacuity, which is based on an understanding that the inherent existence that you'd been believing in before doesn't exist at all. That's called emptiness. That emptiness is not something which is of a different nature than form. It's of the same nature as form. And that's exemplified by the following two lines. Emptiness is not other than form. I have the right order, huh? Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. If emptiness was other than form, there would be a kind of emptiness that you could perceive, the emptiness of form, which you could perceive without form, if it was other than form, if they were separate entities, separate natures. You know, like the color of the turquoise, or the color of the maybe oak table, or, you know, that has a natural color. The color, we could say the color of the oak table, is not different, is not other than the oak table. It's not something other. You know, the oak table is here and the color is somewhere else. They're of one nature. Also, emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. There's no form that you could perceive which has a different kind of quality other than being empty of inherent existence. It itself is not separate from emptiness. So this sequence of statements, as I said before, sometimes you could translate it as fourfold profundity. This was an enigma for a lot of the early scholars of Buddhism. How could things have this kind of relationship? But it was understood there are other things like this in the Buddhist pantheon. Say, for instance, when we talk about the quality of impermanence. You know what impermanence is, right? Subtle impermanence. The momentary change of phenomena, instant by instant. There is a synonym for impermanence. If you were to try to prove that sound is impermanent, you could use one of its synonyms. You could say sound is impermanent because it's a product of causes and conditions. It's a product. It's created. Right? Those two terms, product and impermanence, actually refer to the same phenomena by different intellectual, by different terms, by different intellectual concepts. You could say that sound is impermanent, it's changing from moment to moment. You could also say that form, that sound is produced, it's created, it's a product of causes and conditions. You know, the example of the bell that sometimes in Tantra is used to also illustrate emptiness. But here, you know, the sound of the bell is the product of some activity. It doesn't continually abide there. It has to be created by some causes and therefore will eventually dissipate. Anything that is a product of causes and conditions, when those causes and conditions no longer entail, when you stop ringing the bell, the sound stops. So to be a product is synonymous with being impermanent. But they have different names, and just thinking impermanent doesn't necessarily bring to mind that something is a product. Just thinking that something is a product doesn't necessarily bring to mind that it's impermanent. But it can be used in a logical argument. You can say that sound is impermanent because it's a product. In fact, we know that sound is a product because they're synonyms of one another, product and impermanent. Sound is impermanent because it's a product, those two terms, impermanence and product. So they also have the same kind of relationship of being the same nature, but conceptually different. Product and impermanent. There were many, many attempts to explain this conundrum about the two levels of truth. Say, form is what we call a conventional truth, right? Something that appears to the senses. It is something that conventional truth, when we say that form is a conventional truth, we mean the merely imputed form. That's just the name, the concept that's given to a collection of parts. That's called a conventional truth. That form, by familiarization over numberless lifetimes in the past, appears to us joined with an appearance of inherent existence. There's the appearance of just the merely imputed form and the appearance of an inherently existent form. They're joined from the hip for ordinary beings. The only time that they can be separated and you can perceive one without the other is once you've realized emptiness. Or if you become Buddha, the Buddha can perceive just the conventionally existent form as a mere imputation without it appearing back at him or her as being inherently existent. Making some sense? Some sense, okay. So when we're talking about form and emptiness, we're talking essentially about the two levels of truth, conventional truth and ultimate truth. Remember I mentioned before that the Buddha said and Nagarjuna expounded many hundreds of years later again and again that all phenomena are either conventional truths or ultimate truths, that they are essentially different. There's nothing which is both a conventional truth and an ultimate truth. If anything exists, it has to be either a conventional truth or an ultimate truth. So they are mutually exclusive, right? So when it says form is empty, that means the conventional truth of form is empty of the appearance that is occurring to you, this mixed appearance. The merely imputed I, the conventional truth of a form, conventional form, it is mixed with the appearance of an inherently existent form that seems to be coming back at you. When you impute something, it's coming from your side. A concept is being superimposed on the object. Oh, that's a form. That's an apple tree. That's a man, that's a woman, that's something. You're giving a name. And as soon as you give that name, because of habituation over numberless lifetimes, you've given the name this way, and it appears back at you, it seems like it's coming back at you, that it really exists there, what you're superimposing on it, the name, it's as though the source of the name is there. You gave the name to that collection of parts, but it seems like it's existing from its own side. That appearance of existing from its own side is the appearance of inherent existence, as though the existence was inherent in that thing that you've superimposed, you've designated, you've imputed upon that object a name or concept. Okay. So the conventionally existent form is one which is merely designated, not looking further. Like yesterday, I'm not sure if she's here today. Was it Karen's here? Yesterday I said or Karen or someone else, there is a conventionally existent person. You know, where in Raleigh, where in this house, where in this room, you open up the door and say, where is Karen? You point to that person. That's called conventional analysis, looking at just the merely imputed Karen. But if you're not satisfied with that and you think there must be, it looks like there's a Karen-ness coming from her side, trying to find it within that, the parts of Karen. The parts that we see, of course, are the body, but the parts that we can infer are her mind, because her speech is motivated by her mind, or her activities, her emotions, and so forth. If you look within those parts, you can't find what you thought of as Karen-ness, you know, an inherent nature of Karen. It's due to that kind of analysis that you can come to the conclusion that Karen does not inherently exist. You can come to understand the ultimate nature of the person, or in this case, when we're talking about form, the ultimate nature of the form. The form appears to be inherently existent. We don't notice the mere designated existence, the conventional form, which does exist just as a name or concept, that's overpowered by the appearance of its inherent existence. When you realize that that appearance of inherent existence, although the appearance exists, what our mind is believing that it really does exist that way, our grasping to that is real, that reality that we're grasping to does not exist, we've realized the ultimate truth of that form, that it is empty of inherent existence. So the conventional form being merely imputed and its ultimate nature of being devoid of the reality that is appearing to us when we are looking at or perceiving in some way the conventional form. Those are the two levels of truth of form. So in the same way that the turquoise and the color, lapis lazuli and the color of lapis lazuli are of one nature but conceptually different, how impermanence and product, being a product are synonymous. They're one nature. They're referring to the same thing, but they're conceptually different. Conventional truths and ultimate truths are also one nature, but conceptually different. Like sometimes there's an expression in Italian, I can't remember. Diana, did your family still speak Italian? You remember? Anyway, doesn't matter. She's just turning out. We talk about, in Italian, they talk about, you know, we say the two faces of a coin. What is it? The due facce.
Due facce.
The medallion, the medaglia, something like that.
Del medaglio.
Yeah, the two faces, the two sides of the coin. So there are, the two faces of a coin are one entity. Now you might say, oh no, George, you can separate them. When you said two things are the same entity, if you can't separate them, well, you could say, oh, I've got this really super fine laser saw, and that coin, I can put the laser down the center or the very thin blade, and I get two different medallions. One has a face and one has a tail, or, you know, or whatever. Well, it's no longer a medallion then, right? If you do that. So they are the two faces of the medallion, the two sides of the coin, another way of saying this, conventional truth, the conventional truth of form, that is form. And when we say form here, we mean the conventional form, just the merely imputed form. That is itself empty of inherent existence, and that emptiness of that form is not something that's found somewhere differently. It's the very nature of the form. So form is empty, and that emptiness of the form is the same nature as the form. I always get the order the second two wrong. Emptiness is not other than form. So the emptiness is not something that you can separate from it and find somewhere differently, as though you could realize the emptiness of form without relying on the form. It's not that way. You first have to analyze the form, recognize that it's devoid of inherent existence, and then you recognize its emptiness, which is of the same nature of the form. Now, you might have think, well, isn't there something just called emptiness that doesn't depend on anything else? Just the concept of non-inherent existence. There is no emptiness that exists which is not the emptiness of something. There's no kind of independently existent emptiness floating out here that you can perceive, which is understood without relying on some conventional phenomena as its referent point. This conventionally existent thing is empty of the way it's appearing. Sorry. This conventionally existent thing is empty of existing the way that it appears. That emptiness is one nature with that form. It's not something that can be separated and realized other than the form. Also, the form can't be perceived in such a way that it is not one nature with emptiness, that it is a form which is inherently existent. There's no form which is inherently existent. It's always one with its emptiness. Even emptiness itself, when you think about it, you might think, okay, form is empty, feelings, compositional feelings, discrimination, And sorry, I'm trying to put this to zero volume. There we go. What was I saying? Someone's calling from Milwaukee. I think I heard that they had COVID, but I'll attend to them later. I'm not sure if they'll leave a message or not. They probably think I'm ignoring them. I've heard that they and their mom came down with COVID, and the father, who's I think 86 or 87, hasn't been tested positive yet. So anyway, I think that's what that's about. So emptiness itself, we might think that exists, you know, that something separate from other things. There is an inherently existent emptiness that's just there from its own side. That's not the case either. It's always aligned with some conventional phenomena. And that particular understanding is what's called the emptiness of emptiness. Have you heard of that? I think there's a book talking about this concept just with that title, Emptiness of Emptiness. So this fourfold profundity was analyzed, and later, after many hundreds of years of scholars, Buddhist scholars, trying to delve into the, you know, giving different explanations, getting closer and closer to this, the concept that conveniently is that nowadays that we understand it is we say that these two things, emptiness and the conventional phenomena that is of one nature, that they are one entity and different conceptual constructs. In Tibetan, we say ngo chik. That means, ngo means entity or nature. Chik means one or same. They are one or the same entity. But dokpa tate. Dokpa means the conceptual construct that you have of that. They are, tate means different. They are one entity, but different intellectual constructs. So that is to say, like the two sides of the coin, they are one entity, but different, you know, the head and the tail are perceived differently. Okay? Tough bones. Geshe Sopa, when he was teaching about emptiness in long summer courses, at the beginning of the course, he'd look out and say, this course, we're going to be talking about dry, we're going to be chewing dry bones, you know, sort of like, difficult, you know. So you have to have some patience. Maybe let your saliva get in there and soften up these concepts by familiarity, looking at them from different directions. Finally, things will begin to gel a little bit. So in relation to this, to sort of give some background, one of the kind of concepts that is necessary to have a little background is in what are called contradictions and relationships. So two things are said to be contradictory if they are, first of all, they're different, and that difference can even be conceptual or different in name, like dog and perro, or Tibetan word for dog is chi, dog and chi. They're the same, they're synonyms, but they're verbally different. So they are not exactly the same. So contradictions, two things are different in whatever way, and they don't, let me see the terminology that the Tibetans use. Oh, here we go. Contradiction is defined as abiding in mutual disharmony, mutual discord. Two things are contradictory if they abide in mutual discord. So what does that mean? It means that two things are, for them to be contradictory, they have to be different, and there's no common locus of the two. What is, you know what a common locus is? You maybe know from mathematics, especially if you teach mathematics. Common locus means something which is both. Is there something which is both a conventional truth and an ultimate truth? Remember what I said before? Is there something which is both a conventional truth and an ultimate truth? Some people are nodding yes. But the answer is this one. You might say, wait, I'm confused. I thought you said they're the same nature. Being the same nature doesn't mean that they're the same. Nagarjuna, quoting the Buddha, said, all phenomena are either conventional truths or ultimate truths. Right? They're different. And they are... there's no common locus. There's not something which is a conventional truth and an ultimate truth. You might say, wait, you said the coin. That's talking about something else. We'll get to that in a second. Contradiction means the two things are different. They're contradictory. If they're different and there's no common locus between them, there's nothing, not one basis which is both. So the two faces of the coin, when you look at the head or the tail, if you want to put it that way, the head is not the tail. There is not a head which is a tail, right? There is not a tail which is a head, unless you're making some coin that has a small head in the back of the tail or something like that. You know, I'm talking about the two things. There is no conventional truth, which is an ultimate truth. Why is that? Well, conventional truths necessarily appear to ordinary beings like us as inherently existent. But ultimate truths do not appear to be inherently existent. They are actual truths, because their way of existing is the way that they appear, or their way of appearing is how they actually exist. They don't appear to be inherently existent, and they are not inherently existent. Conventional truths appear to be inherently existent, but they are empty of inherent existence. So conventional truths, like form, and ultimate truth, like emptiness, are contradictory. So when interpreting the verse, when it says form is empty, emptiness is form, you might think, well, emptiness, it says verbally emptiness is form, but what is meant there is that emptiness is the nature of form. They're of one nature. They're different conceptual constructs. They're actually contradictory. Okay, there's no common locus of them. So there's two kinds of contradictions. Have you heard this before? No. Two kinds of contradictions. I'll use the actual words and we'll interpret to what it means. One of them is called contradiction in the sense of being mutually abandoned, mutual abandonment. Tibetan says pensum panggal. Gal means contradictory. Pang means to abandon. Pensum means mutual. That means if it is one of them, the other, it cannot be the other. Let's see, example here. So this one is in the sense of they abide discordantly. Remember, that's the general meaning of contradiction. They're if they abide, they're discordant with one another in the sense of being excluded and included. So if you include one thing, the other part of the contradiction is excluded. If you put the other one there, the first thing is excluded. They're mutually exclusive. What's an example of that in everyday life? Can you think of it, two things that are mutually exclusive?
Light and dark.
Light and dark. If the room is light, if there is light, it excludes darkness, I guess you could say, yeah.
Or like red and blue, like are two different colors, but red purple and blue are kind of the same. Like purple and blue are kind of the same, but red and blue are definitely different. If it's red, it's not blue. If it's blue,
right.
It's not.
Okay, there's a good example. Second kind of contradiction is this contradiction in the sense of not abiding, not abiding in the sense of mutual abandonment, which we just talked about, that they're mutually exclusive, and not abiding together without harming. So this would be something like, ignorance and wisdom do not abide together in one place without harming one another. There might be a little bit of ignorance and development of wisdom, but either one of them is going to win out over the other. They're kind of attacking one another. A classic example is like a crow and an owl. Have you ever heard of that? Is there something in our culture about crow and an owl can't abide on the same branch without attacking one another? This kind of contradiction involves the actual displacement of one thing by the other. The two cannot inhabit the same place, whether it be consciousness in the case of wisdom and ignorance, or the limb of a tree in the case of an owl and a crow. They're contradictory in that sense that they harm one another.
Would that be like winning and losing?
Well, winning and losing, if you talked about it, you know, there's all sorts of subtleties here. You say, so sometimes if you lose, you say, I still won. I won't name any person that says that, but, you know. But in general, if you win, you cannot lose. So they're mutually exclusive. That's the first kind of contradiction. Harming one another would be trying to hold in your mind two different contradictory philosophical views, or two different kind of religious views, that there is an internal self of the eternal soul of the Abrahamic religions, and that the self or soul or atma is empty of existing the way that it appears. Those would be maybe harming one another, right? Like ignorance and wisdom. They can be, you can try to hold them in the same together, but one is going to, you know, they're going to be contradictory in the sense that one harms the other. So you're left in a mind of indecision, right? Wisdom of emptiness and the ignorance that grasps the true existence, they might abide together in your mind in a mixed way, but one is, they're harming one another. They're contradictory in that way. But there are other things that are mutually exclusive, like, let's say, winning and losing, or being red and, what would you say, red and blue and so forth. So in these terms, form and emptiness, so form is a conventional truth, right? And emptiness, the ultimate truth, they're contradictory in the sense that they are different, because they're different names, the different conceptual understandings, and there's no common locus of the two. There is nothing that is both form and emptiness. Again, you might say, well, you brought up, George, that example of the medallion with the two faces. It's not, the medallion itself is showing the relationship between these two truths, that they can't be separated. We're going to be talking about that in a second in terms of the relationship between them. Here we're talking about whether the individual head or the tail, the conventional truth or the ultimate truth, whether there's one thing that is both. If you look at one side of the medallion, you see the head. You look at the other side, you see the tail. If you look at the form, you see the conventional truth. If you look at the emptiness, you see the ultimate truth. They're different than one another. They are contradictory in the sense of being mutually exclusive, right? Where the fact that something is form, if something is form, it eliminates the possibility that it is emptiness. Now, remember I said that these two levels of truth, they form one entity, one nature, but ordinary beings, we can only perceive directly one of those at a time. When we're not in meditative equipoise, we perceive the conventional reality, like the forms, sounds, smells, taste, tactile sensations, and so forth. When we're in meditative equipoise and emptiness, we perceive the ultimate truth. We can't perceive both at the same time. We can't perceive the emptiness of the form and the form at the same time. Whereas a Buddha can perceive both, because of the fact when form appears to the Buddha's mind, it doesn't appear as inherently existent. Remember I said for our minds, the form, just the conventionally existent form, which is imputed from our mind, immediately appears back to us as being inherently existent. The conventionally existent form and the appearance of an inherently existent form, they're mixed. We can't extricate them. To a Buddha, just the designated form, the conventional form, can appear without appearing as inherently existent. So he can perceive both levels of truth at the same time. Throwing a lot at you here. But, Karen, you have a question. Yeah, let's take a...
Yeah, so I'm wondering, if you talk about being able to see the form as it really is, I'm taking that to mean being able to see the form without all the meaning that we layer onto the form, that we give it from our own mind, like when we see a car, we label it car, we think we could drive it, we think maybe somebody owns it, we think maybe we need to wash it, we think car-ness things on it. So I'm taking it to mean when you say like a Buddha would see that as a car, but also as just some object. It would be like without all that meaning of carness. Is that what?
Not exactly. Here we're talking about, we're getting down to something very, very precise. We're not talking about when we say car, that we're thinking about car things. You know, I can drive it and, you know, that it can crash and, oh, how much my insurance company is. And if I spent 15 minutes, I could save 15% or more with Geico or something like that. We're not talking about any of those things. We're talking about just the way that it appears. When you look at your car, what kind of car do you have?
I have a blue car.
No, what brand? What?
It's a BMW. It's a convertible.
Okay, you have a BMW. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you think, if someone were to scratch their key on the side of their door, your door, because you offended them in Starbucks or something, or, you know, you bumped into them, whatever, and you see that and it's like, my BMW. It's so, it's because of the fact that when we see those parts arranged in that way, they appear to be really existent from their own side. And our mind then, because of that basic grasping, we accelerate that, we intensify that by attachment. I assume you're attached to your BMW, unless it's an old beat-up thing and you'd like to get rid of it. A little bit attached, okay. So we might be fed up with our BMW because it costs so much to repair or whatever, so we're angry with it. But because of it appearing to exist from its own side, that acts as an accelerant to both attachment, anger, jealousy, all of the different mental factors take as their basis, so their genesis of believing an inherent existent I and inherently existent other phenomena. They really exist the way that they appear. So here we're talking about the appearance of the car, simply not in terms of it's drivable or you know, cost a lot or anything. We're talking about just the way that it appears as existing from its own side, not just merely a name we give to those collection of parts.
So physically appearing, the actual physical appearance that we perceive with our eye consciousness looks different.
So what appears to our eyes is a collection of parts. You said yours is blue, maybe blue paint on this thing. And those parts that and that we've come familiar with, and the fact that it's parked in your driveway and so forth, you recognize that as not only a car, but my car, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not talking here, once you've given the label car to that collection of parts, it's as though, although you've given the name car to that, it's as though car appears to be from the side of the parts, as though you could find it if you searched within those parts.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there is no such car that you could find. It is empty of existing from its own side. It seems to be existing from its own side. Once you give the name, it immediately sort of bounces back to you, almost like an echo. You know, you've given the name, you said something, it bounces off the object, and the conventional car that you've named, this is car, my car, it's mixed with the appearance coming as though it's coming back to you as an inherently existent car that didn't depend on you giving a name. Whether you called it my car or not, it would have been your car. It would be car whether you called it car or not.
So could we say that we're, instead of talking about just the ideas I have about the car, we're talking about like a Buddha might actually see, let's just say, I don't know that this is the way it is, I'm not there, that a Buddha might see all the individual atoms and molecules, whereas I see a car. Like, he might see the energy of it or something, and also
That's kind of like one of the commentaries you'd read by one of the New Age authors or something. I'm not talking about that. How do phenomena come into existence? You might say, oh, they're, you know, it's made in the factory, or it's produced by atoms or something like that. When we talk about phenomena, we talk about how we recognize things. A tree. This particular, out my window, I can see some trees. A tree is a name that we give to a particular thing that we've come to recognize. We can recognize the generality of tree, even though they have many different appearances, right?
Right. Universal tree.
Yeah. Just thought that's a tree.
Mm-hmm.
But in essence, that is a particular kind of tree that has particular characteristics. But the generality of tree is something that we label upon that, and as though tree-ness exists there, once we've labeled it tree, the concept that we have of tree, as though it can be found somewhere there. Whereas, let's say in a movie theater, you're sitting and you're watching a movie. But if you, and you're getting involved in the movie, you're getting involved into like this real drama taking place there that you're emotionally invested in. If you sort of sit back for a second and you see the projector behind you is projecting on what would otherwise be a blank screen,
mm-hmm.
some scene, and once everything's coming from the projector, right? But it appears that it's coming to you from the screen. It's actually, that's kind of like a reflection, right? In a sense, yeah. It's the dispersal of the light, the photons and so forth that are reflecting off the screen back at you, and it forms some appearance. So like that, there is a continue when we talk about the evolution of phenomena, why things take place, we talk about phenomena are dependent arisings.
Mm-hmm.
They arise in one sense, very gross sense, they arise in dependence on causes and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk about the infallibility of the law of cause and effect. We've created karma in the past, actions in the past, mm-hmm. out of our delusions. Sometimes we might call them virtuous, but and they're not based on delusions, but they're still based on ego grasping, believing in true existence of myself and so forth. Because of those actions we've created in the past, there is an appearance that we experience in any one life that is the result of those actions of the past. That appearance seems to be findable. We give names to things. Mom, dad, BMW, you know, Prius, you know, color, tree, whatever. We give names. And as soon as we do that, the appearances take on a reality to us as though they are findable there. They're not just appearances, but there's something real there. As though Brad Pitt is out there being stabbed by the spear, you know. I always kept giving that example recently. I can't remember why. I think it came up in some article I read. You know the movie? I think he played, what was it, in the Trojan Wars. You know, he played Paris or something like that and gets killed in it or something. Anyway.
Is it sort of like the rope snake then? Like the Buddha?
Yeah, kind of like the rope snake. Now we're getting more to it. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
So the rope, a mottled rope that is kind of like two colors woven together in the corner, kind of, oh my gosh, you know, has it ever happened to you? Maybe you've mistaken something like that for an actual snake.
Yes.
Never from the beginning was there a snake there. But because it appears to your mind as snake and you believe that, fear can rise.
Right.
Okay. I'll tell you what, let's take a little break. It's just 2:30. Let's take a 2:32. Let's take an 8-minute break. Is that okay? And so you can either, you know, go to the bathroom or whatever, have a cup of tea, and we'll come back after that. Okay?
Please repeat, my computer hiccuped. When are we coming back?
In about 8 minutes. Or
Thank
10
you.
Minutes. Okay? 8 or 10 minutes. Whatever you choose. We'll go slowly. I'm giving a seminar on the Heart Sutra on Zoom for the Kadampa Center in Raleigh, period. You called when I was explaining form is empty, comma, emptiness is form. Here I am.
Question?
So David said my microphone was on when I was walking down the stairs calling back my friend. So you heard that I think Donna muted
me. I muted you, yeah.
That's okay. There's nothing secret. I just said that she could watch on YouTube Live. That's right, right? Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, good. So I'll let people slowly drift back. Yeah, Susie, you have a question?
Of course. There's a lot of them.
Okay.
Looking at Jeffrey Hopkins, he talks about an emptiness. And the reason I bring that up is it helps me understand some parts of this, I think. You said there's no emptiness that exists that is not an emptiness of something.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's right.
So it's a concept?
It's a concept, but it is a reality. When we talk about truth, we talk about the two truths, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned before that ultimate truth is the only real, is actual truth. That is to say, when we say something is truth, that means it exists the way that it appears, you know, as opposed to someone who's lying to us, who said, oh, yes, you know, I'll always have your back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're lying, they appear one way. They appear sincere, but they're actually insincere. So that's a falsity. Most of the things that we experience are falsities. The only thing that exists the way that it appears in this most subtle sense is ultimate truth.
Truth, yeah.
Because it appears to be inherent, appears to be empty of inherent existence, and it is empty of inherent existence. All conventional truths, faces, fences, cars, Prius, BMWs, they all appear to be inherently existent, but they're actually empty of inherent existence. So they're not true. They're called conventional truths, or as I mentioned, they're true for an ignorant mind, or as Jeffrey Hopkins says, true for a jerk.
So.
Say, I won't, you know, I could make some political allusions here about certain things that are being stated to be true nowadays that certain people believe to be true, but, okay, you can make your
own.
But
we can see behind that, though. So, an emptiness, then, you said, yes, it is a concept, I think, but there's always an add-on that my conception of the concept
there is no phenomena that exists which is not merely imputed. So in that sense, you might say it's a concept, but when you say it is a concept, it almost sounds like there are some things that are not concepts. Everything that we know can be conceptually understood, but also, phenomena can be experienced directly. Without the...
That's why they say direct. I was going to say then, if it's a concept, it's my concept, and it could be crazy.
Just so other people here.
Yeah.
So, although it can be conceptually understood, it can also be directly understood.
Mm-hmm.
When you understand emptiness conceptually, at that point, to your mind, it's appearing to be inherently existent, but you might analyze it and understand that it's not. But when you have a direct realization of it,
Yeah.
The appearance to your mind is that it's empty of inherent existence, and you're knowing, and it is empty of inherent existence. So it is an ultimate truth like that. So there's no concept involved in that direct realization.
Okay. So my concept of emptiness is a regular concept, conventional. Well, and maybe someday soon, someday I'll have the direct.
Okay, so even among conceptual understandings or conceptual thinking about something, there are some that are correct, there are some that are incorrect.
Okay.
Probably for most of us, our concept of emptiness, we've built up a mental image of emptiness, which is the basis for our concept of it, and it may or may not be factually concordant. By that I mean it may not actually be the way emptiness is. If you haven't realized emptiness directly, you can realize it conceptually. That is, realization means that your understanding of it is eliminated superimpositions and has gotten to the actual essence of that. So you can have a conceptual realization of emptiness, but still, to that conceptual realization, emptiness is appearing as inherently existent. The only time it doesn't appear as inherently existent is when you have a direct realization of it.
So that's the last little subtle bit.
So say, for instance, before the path of seeing, before you've realized emptiness, there's still some veils in the mind, so to speak. There's still the appearance to conception of emptiness, and it necessarily, that appearance appears to be inherently existent, but you may use correct reasonings to prove that it's not. You may have that correct understanding of it, but if you look in a certain way, you see that it is appearing to be inherently there. The only time that it doesn't appear that way is when you have a direct realization of emptiness. The Buddha, the omniscient mind, has reached a point where all of the conceptual states of mind are no longer present. The Buddha perceives everything directly. How does he perceive what we think of as, you know, the reality that we attribute to our BMW or our Prius or our face or a friend or whatever? How does I thought someone was moaning.
No, I said,
So how does the Buddha perceive that? By perceiving our minds. The Buddha doesn't, you know, to us, because of our particular karma, we have a karmic appearance, which is arisen because of dependence on cause and effect. It said that the law of cause and effect is infallible. By cause and effect, I mean karma and its results. The results are these appearances, even the appearances of feelings. Feelings are also our appearances to our mind, our reactions to them, right? They don't inherently exist. It seems like, oh, they're so unbearable. So some critiques of the Mahayana says, why is if according to you Mahayanists, other phenomena, not just the person, if other phenomena are empty, why should the Buddha have compassion for sentient beings? Because these things don't exist. Well, they appear, and their grasp is real, and people suffer as a result of that. And out of compassion, the Buddha wants to alleviate that. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Barbara. You're trying to find the mute unmute button.
There we go. Is the emptiness, from what I'm grasping, get it? From what I'm trying to think of, if what I'm trying to think of emptiness isn't blackness, it isn't void as in total blackness of outer space or something, but it's a conceptual, is it that it's impermanent part of it?
No. Emptiness
is permanent. That we
emptiness is permanent. So first of all, emptiness is not black. Black is a color.
Right, I know that. Right.
So, like, for instance, the meditation we did at the beginning, mm-hmm. you know, almost 2 hours ago, I said the nature of the mind, the conventional clear light nature of the mind, is like, I might not have used the word today, but it's like space. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the space that you see with your eye that has a color, you know, blue, or in a cloudy day, you know, gray or something. It doesn't have any color. It's something that is perceived by the eye of wisdom, I said. Prajna. Prajna generally means wisdom. So that is a faculty of the mental consciousness. It's not something that you can make an analogy with to outer, you know, to outer phenomena.
Right.
Like, say, for instance, when I talk about space, generally, there are different kinds of meaning of space in Buddhist philosophy. The general meaning of space, the philosophical meaning of space, akasha,
mm-hmm.
is the lack of obstructing contact, the mere absence or vacuity of obstructing contact. So, for instance, I can infer that there's no... that there is space here because my hand is not obstructed as I move back and forth. And you might say, oh, I can see that space because I don't see anything. Actually, if there were crystal, translucent crystal there, I might think that's space, you know, the people walking into glass doors and so forth. Actual space is only perceived by the mental consciousness. So it doesn't have a particular color. When we say it is clear light, the sense of clarity, one of the senses of clarity is that, you know, just talking about the nature of the mind, conventional mind, the clarity is that there's no obstruction. You know, thoughts can come, emerge into the consciousness and disappear like a cloud that's evaporated by the sun on a summer day, right? The cloud seems to be there, and then if you just wait long enough, it's not like it goes anywhere. It's evaporated and there's no longer cloud there. So if you take your attention away from the thought, the object of the thought within the clarity of your mind, that thought can begin to dissipate and you can just be again be perceiving that lack of obstruction to thoughts. So the clear light nature of the mind is like that. Similarly, emptiness has a similar a kind of appearance. It doesn't have a color. It's not black or white or blue. When we talk about the space-like meditation on emptiness, it doesn't mean like blue sky, although you might think that. It's something that's perceived by the mind in the same way, the mere lack of or absence of inherent existence.
Okay.
That realization, that understanding, not implying anything else there in its place. That's what's called a non-affirming negation. You're negating inherent existence, and in so doing, you're not replacing it with something else.
And it's not like impermanent.
Pardon?
This is completely different than being just impermanent.
Well, the question of impermanent is the, let's say, form and its emptiness. Form is impermanent. It's a conventional phenomenon, right? The emptiness of form is permanent. They're one nature. You might say, hold on. How can one side of the medallion be permanent and the other side impermanent? One, you know, they're one entity. Well, emptiness is of a category of phenomena that are called, temporary permanence. the emptiness of the form comes into existence when the form is created, like say a mug or my Pepsi can, right? So there is the Pepsi can, or the can, mug, whatever you want to call it, this conventional phenomena that is just merely imputed by my mind on an appearance and appears back to me as inherently existent, but say the conventional can. And then there's the emptiness of the can, the fact that the appearance of coming from the can, the inherent existence, is not there at all, that understanding. That emptiness of the can is a permanent phenomenon. While the can exists, the emptiness of the can exists. When the can is crushed, melted, or whatever, is no longer recognized as a can,
okay. Yeah.
The emptiness of the can no longer exists.
Because
all during the period while the can was existing, the emptiness of the can was existing without changing. It never varied from being empty of inherent existence. It never sort of wavers up. Part a little bit inherently existent, now completely empty. Never, always empty of inherent existence. So that's it's not momentary. Impermanent phenomena are things that moment by moment change. They may appear to be the same or similar moment by moment, like a big rock in your yard. Oh, that's permanent. That's not going to change. But it's eroding every second. The atoms within it are vibrating and so forth. Eventually, it will disintegrate, if not sooner. So emptiness is permanent. It's one side of the medallion, and the phenomena that it is the emptiness of can be impermanent. Well, you can also have the emptiness of space. Space itself is permanent. When I talk about akasha, the lack of obstructing contact, you might say, well, wait, if you put something there, if you put a big rock here, there's no longer space, you might say. So the space is not permanent. Well, no. Mm-hmm. The fact that the rock is there shows you there has to be space there. It never changed from being non-obstructing.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there's an obstruction here is due to the rock, but the space still remains there. Otherwise, the rock would not be there. If there was no space there, you couldn't have the rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
I alluded to that when we talked about when the thoughts come in your mind. Even the thoughts are like a kamikaze attack, you know. Oh, worry, you know. Is he going to stay in office? Is he going to whatever, you know, is going on in your mind. So many thoughts. They could only be there if there was spaciousness of the mind. The same way that the rock can only be here in physical space if that space lacked obstructing contact. If that space where the rock is was obstructive, I couldn't move the rock there. I'd get close to it and I'd be obstructed. The fact that the rock goes there means that there is space there, even though we might say that there's no space there. So that's something that's understood by the eye of wisdom. Mm-hmm. Same thing with emptiness. Okay. Same thing with the clarity of the mind. You know, you can understand, even though the thoughts are there, the space, the clear light nature of the mind has not disappeared. It's still there. The fact that the thoughts, the concepts are there indicate that the mind is clear light nature, non-obstructing. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go a little bit further. Okay. So we can call the fourfold profundity. That's not, everyone doesn't call it that. That's a little bit philosophical terminology that came into existence. But form is empty. And remember, I said in some of the presentations of the sutra, it says form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. When I translated, I think they used my translation, the FPMT, that I translated when the Dalai Lama came to, where was it, in California, sort of near Silicon Valley in a big stadium. And FPMT had requested it, so they used my translation. So I had written form is empty, emptiness is form, because that's the usual in our Galupa Yiksha, our Galupa manuals of the Heart Sutra, it always says, Suk Tong Bao, Tong Ba Ni Suk So. Form is empty, emptiness is form. And generally, that's in the Galupa tradition how we say it. But in the version the Dalai Lama took from the Kangyur, the collection of the Buddhist scriptures, it says, Suk Tong Ba Ni, Tong Ba Ni Suk So. So it says form is emptiness. So I was a little bit embarrassed. So there are both versions, so just different interpretations. But generally, what we've talked about, that form and the emptiness of form are one entity, but different conceptual constructs. There we say ngochik topatade, that still holds for that. So after having said that, Avalokiteshvara continues saying, in the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. So why does he choose those four things, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness? Because in the famous category of the five skandhas, or five aggregates, form is generally the first one, and then feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. And by consciousness, these others are consciousness, but by consciousness here, it means primary consciousness. You know the difference between the mental factors and primary consciousness? Jennifer knows. She's nodding yes. Anyone else know? So, primary mind, primary consciousness knows the general entity of its object. Like eye consciousness knows color and shape. The mental factors within eye consciousness, and there are mental factors there, discrimination and feeling and so forth, they know particular aspects of it. They discriminate one part of the visual field, one color, the edge where two colors come together or merge or something. They can discriminate that. But primary consciousness knows the mere entity of the perceptual field. So it's the same case, the same as with form. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. You could say feeling is empty. Emptiness is feeling. Emptiness is not other than feeling. Feeling is not other than emptiness. So remember I said that at the beginning, Avalokiteshvara's answer to Shariputra, that the Bodhisattvas correctly and repeatedly perceive view the emptiness of the five aggregates also. So the implication there is that generally the non-bodhisattvas, the practitioners of the lesser vehicle, Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, they take as their main object the non-inherent existence of the person. Only peripherally talking about the emptiness of the basis upon which the person is imputed, the body, the feelings, the discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness. They only consider they're empty in that they're not objects of utilization by a inherently existent person, generally. It's only further along the path that close, if they actually achieve nirvana, that they will realize that emptiness. So he's saying that the bodhisattvas meditate on the emptiness of the five aggregates also. The five aggregates were enunciated by the Buddha as the main components of the person. Like I said, if you took apart the Prius or the, what was it, BMW, you'd have a pile of steel and metal and glass and rubber and petroleum and different kinds of things. Maybe there's some wood in your car if you've got an expensive car, glass and so forth. So the five piles that you can divide a person into for this kind of analysis are those five. So you could just say there's two piles, body and mind. If you broke up mind, you could say primary mind and secondary mind. So the question arises, why is secondary mind divided into three parts? Because feelings are secondary minds or mental factors, we call them. Discriminations are mental factors. And compositional factors are all the rest of the mental factors. So you get to end up with five, right? Form, consciousness, and three varieties of mental factors. Why are feeling and discrimination separated out? Well, there might be some tantric reasons for that, but in the sutras, in the Abhidharma Kosha question, you know, Vasubandhu answers that question. He says that because feeling and discrimination are the main causes for the laity and the religious or scholars, let's say, to engage in samsara, the main reasons for their engagement. So ordinary beings, like I'd say, if someone is listening from Milwaukee, I'm not sure if she's on YouTube Live yet, the meat and potatoes, you know, I think of Milwaukee, kind of Chicago where I grew up, meat and potatoes kind of people, you know, everything's about feelings, good food, you know, drink, you know, exercising one's ego and so forth, but feelings. So that's the main way that the laity, you might say, the main cause of their engagement with samsara, out of desire for feelings. Yeah. No, you muted again. No, you're still muted. There you go. There you go.
This is Patrick.
And, Patrick. Yeah, I see.
It might be helpful just to define what feelings are as opposed to emotions.
Right. So feelings here, so like we say, oh, I have feelings for you or something like that, emotions or something. That's not the meaning here. Feelings are the experience of pain, pleasure, or neutrality. There are three types. So, and you can delineate in different ways. There's physical feelings within the body consciousness. Something is pleasurable, smooth, what is it, you know, the 80 threads per inch cotton sheets or something like that. Or let's say, you know, someone embracing you or sexual pleasure. All of these would be called physical pleasure. There's physical pain that's obviously recognized if you get stung by a bee or so forth. And neutral feelings. Right now, if I ask you, how does your right earlobe feel right now? Does it feel pleasant? Not particularly bad. It's kind of neutral feeling. Kind of not bad, not good. Kind of Goldilocks, you know. Also, the other kind of feeling is the feeling of consciousness, mental feelings. So they are more important. Mental bliss, mental happiness, mental discomfort and unhappiness, and mental neutral feeling. Sometimes you're just sitting in, You don't feel particularly happy or unhappy. So those, that's what's meant by feeling here. So ordinary beings, laity, their main rationale of engaging in cyclic existence is to experience pleasurable feelings and to exclude unpleasant feelings. You know, you talk about all of the different kinds of things. Is Robbie still here? I can't see. I was going to talk about fine foods.
I'm still here, yes.
I don't see. You must be on the next window or something. So, oh, there you are. So, you know, there's some people that try to make every moment of their life pleasurable. Wines and foods and so forth. Both physically pleasurable, you know, the gustatory feeling of the tongue and the palate and so forth would still be physical feeling. But then as a result of that, the mind feels satisfaction. Even though, you know, sometimes if your mind is bummed out, even if you drink the best wine that might otherwise give you pleasure, intellectual pleasure, mental pleasure, if your mind is bummed out, it doesn't bring you pleasure, right? Or if you're experiencing some other kind of pain in the body. So anyway, the reason in the Abhidharma Kosha, it's mentioned that the mental factors are divided into these three categories: the feelings, discriminations, and all the rest of the mental factors, and some other things that are impermanent called compositional factors aggregate. The reason ordinary people enter into samsara due to their feelings predominantly, whereas the logicians, you might say, kind of derogatory, sort of like people that are mainly intellectual, we say intellectual. So we can say the anti-intellectuals based on feeling and the intellectuals more on discrimination. You know, what is correct? You know, discriminate. Oh, your theories are wrong. My theories are right. You know, so forth and so on. And as a result, develop attachment to your own position, antipathy to others' position, jealousy of others being more famous than you, and so forth. But in general, you could say there are three aggregates: form, mental factors, secondary mental factors, and primary consciousness, other than dividing the mental factors into feeling, discrimination, and all the rest. So here, what Avalokiteshvara is saying is it's not just for form, the form aggregate, that form is empty and that emptiness is form. It's the same thing with the feeling aggregate. Feelings, although they appear to your mind, experience of your mind, when I say appear to your mind, that is the experience of them to your mind, seems to be so real, like they're existing there inherently. If you have an understanding of emptiness, if you realize at that moment that they are empty of inherent existence, the irritation to your mind is diminished. You can actually alleviate that by realizing emptiness. Discriminations are empty of inherent existence. Their emptiness is of the same nature as the discriminations. Emptiness is not different entity, cannot be found different than the discriminations, and you can't have discriminations that are not empty. The same four factors, fourfold profundity applies to them. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra. So one of the commentaries that says what he says, he's calling, you know, he's like you're talking to someone and you say, you know, this, and hey, Robbie, hey, Jampa, you know, you sort of say, listen carefully. Shariputra. Likewise, all phenomena are emptiness. So here, in this, in even in the Galupa translations, Remember we said form is empty, emptiness is form. I said in some of the renditions it says form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Here it goes back to that original kind of thing. All phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not stainless. Here it says not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. And so some of the commentators, after calling the first statement the fourfold profundity, they call this the eightfold profundity. So in the same way, they say Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena, you could say, are empty. It's not just the five aggregates. All phenomena are of the nature of emptiness, that they are empty of inherent existence, without characteristics. So generally, when we talk about characteristics of phenomena, we talk about general and specific characteristics. So the general characteristics of my computer are things that are shared with other things, like that that it's impermanent, that it's empty of inherent existence. Its specific characteristics are kind of like its defining, specific defining characteristics, like it's made of aluminum or it's got plastic parts, it's got a screen, you know, the different defining characteristics. So in one sense, all phenomena are empty or emptiness without inherently existent characteristics, even the specific characteristics. Emptiness is kind of like an example of a general characteristic. When it mentions characteristics separately, it's kind of inferring the specific characteristics of things. Not only their general characteristics are empty, that is, they are empty of inherent existence, but their specific characteristics, the color, the shape, the duration or whatever kind of characteristics is something, they are also empty of inherent existence. Excuse me. All phenomena are unproduced, unceased. So the different interpretations of the various shastras about this, you could talk about, in general, impermanent phenomena have a period of production and a period of disintegration, right? What's the word that's used here? Ceasing, you know, cessation. Sometimes in the Abhidharma, it says creation, abidance, and disintegration, right? Generally, in the higher tenets, when we talk about impermanent phenomena, their evolution, we talk about the period of their arisal and their period of cessation. Actually, if you talk about the universe, we talk about the evolution of a universal system, you know, the period of arising. Then the period of abidance means when things are sort of more or less stable, and then the period of disintegration. And what's the fourth period? So the period of empty, right? So there's nothing there. Those are the four kalpas that when we talk about the evolution and dissolution of a universal system.
Could you repeat those, please?
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
The period of evolution, kind of like maybe the big bang and things spreading out. Then the period when everything is abiding more or less stably. And then the period of disintegration, maybe if you talk about the eventual collapse of a universe, if you talk about an oscillating universe, kind of like that, things are coming to an end. And then at the end, nothing, there's nothing there, just empty, a kalpa of empty. before another evolution of a universe. So sometimes it's understood that phenomena, you know, we talk about ordinary phenomena in the Hinayana, we say, you know, the form is produced, and then it's a period of abidance when it's stable. It's not being produced any longer. It's there. Like the sprout is produced, and then the sprout is there, and then the sprout disintegrates, flower or whatever. But in general, we talk about the moment that something is produced, it already, the next moment, it is disintegrating. There's no real period of abidance. So in the 12 links, when we talk about, what's it called? Birth with or without aging. Do you know what I'm talking about? When birth, as I say, you know the 12 links? What's the link I'm talking about here, Jennifer? Do you know?
No, ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness, name and form, six sense spheres, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, existence, well, birth.
Aging and death.
Aging and death.
Yeah. So the last link, aging and death, it actually says aging with or without death. So, or let's say death with or without aging. So if a mind stream enters into a fertilized egg and exists there for some time, you might say the second instant it begins aging. But if the consciousness enters into the fertilized egg and immediately leaves, there's never a moment of aging. There is death. So death with or without aging is one of the ways that is translated. So here, when we're talking about Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are empty or emptiness without characteristic, no inherently existent general or specific characteristics, unproduced and unceased. So one way of understanding this is that the production of a sprout or the production of something, its evolution, is not inherently existent. In fact, in the Fundamental Wisdom by Nagarjuna, when we talk about the proof of emptiness, Nagarjuna mainly takes the emptiness of production as analysis. You know, that how is there something that you can locate? Production is a process, you might say. Can you find production anywhere? Is a sprout produced from the seed, which is of a different entity than the sprout, or is it produced from itself, such that the sprout was already there in the seed and so forth? Many, many ways of analyzing. In the end, one could say that even a process like production cannot be inherently found. Like when we do the dedication, meditation on the emptiness of the three spheres, when we dedicate our merits, do you remember? The process of dedicating, connecting these merits with those results, or those merits with these results, whatever you want to say, it's a process. You can't find dedication, inherently existent dedication, on any of those parts. It's just a name you attribute to that process. Also, production is simply a name or concept you attribute to this gradual evolution. Same thing with the ceasing, the cessation of something. So you can talk about the cessation of the delusions or just the cessation of a sprout is a process, and that it does not inherently exist. Stainless without stainless, not without stain, or stainless, not stainless, means One way of understanding means that our minds are not inherently stained by cyclic existence, by being in cyclic existence. And once attaining nirvana, our minds are not inherently unstained. Those states also are empty of inherent existence. Whether the mind is contaminated or uncontaminated, contaminated or uncontaminated meaning stained or unstained, stainless or unstainless, let's say the Buddha. Sometimes we think, oh, the Buddha really, you know, all these we sentient beings are just imputedly existed or whatever, but the Buddha really exists. Also, Buddha doesn't inherently exist. To an appearance which has a conventional validity of having purified the mind, developed all the good qualities, we can impute the name Buddha or omniscient mind, but it doesn't exist from its own side. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are empty or emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. So that can refer to the sense of sentient beings lacking qualities. You know, we say, I don't have any good qualities. I'm just a humble being. I'm a jerk. I'm so bad. There's no inherently existent deficiency of qualities in the ordinary state. And there's no inherently existent fulfillment of qualities in the state of Buddhahood. They're all empty of inherent existence. So this is now relating to things like processes, you might say, entities and processes that are everything that exists is empty of inherent existence. Shariputra, again, calling Shariputra to attention, listen. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. So these were what the five aggregates again, right? We used the five aggregates when we talked about the fourfold profundity. So the statement here, in emptiness, when we get a little bit further tomorrow, when we talk about the mantra and how the stages of development are implicitly present in the Heart Sutra, you know, sort of the stages of the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of no more learning, five paths. When we talk about that, implicit in the sutra here are talking about various stages. So here, when it says in emptiness, this is talking about in the meditative state, when you have a direct realization of emptiness, in emptiness. So to that mind that is perceiving emptiness, there is no form, there is no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factor, no consciousness. So whatever you were meditating on the emptiness of, say you were meditating on the emptiness of form, meditate. So you're analyzing form, why it, you know, you've located the object of negation, that it seems to be existing from its own side. You use logical reasonings to prove that it doesn't exist that way. And then at that moment, what appears to your mind is just a vacuity, whether it be a conceptual understanding of vacuity or a direct realization of vacuity, the emptiness. At that point, the form, if you were meditating on the emptiness of the form no longer is appearing to your mind. In the direct realization of emptiness, this is in emptiness. Sometimes the sutra says in the Dharma Dhatu, means in the sphere of emptiness. there are no conventional phenomena appearing to your mind. There is no form. There's no feeling. There's no discrimination. There's no compositional factors in those. There is no consciousness. Five aggregates, right? There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. You might think he's just pulling different things out here, right? It's just like a grab bag of different things. So this is talking, there's six things mentioned here, right? No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Six things. So these are called, this is what is being referred to as the six sources or the six ayatana. Oh, no, it's 12. The six faculties, we could say, six faculties. So what are the six faculties? Whenever you have a consciousness arising, there are three factors that are necessary, three conditions. There is what's called the dominant condition, which means the sense faculty. In the case of seeing something, for an eye consciousness to arise, an ordinary person, we have to have an eye faculty. Eye faculty doesn't mean this eyeball, you know, this you could pull out. You sometimes see in tankas like an eyeball being offered or something. It doesn't mean that. The eye faculty is a subtle material in perhaps what we call the retina in that area, kind of like in the retina of the eye, there are some receptors called rods and cones. Is that right? Do I remember correctly? Even that is not the eye faculty. The eye faculty is subtle matter within the rods and cones that act as an interface for the consciousness, the eye consciousness to abide there, and for an image to be projected upon that faculty, eye faculty, acts as the interface between the consciousness and the object of the consciousness, in this case, form and color. Same thing with the ear faculty. The ear faculty is actually a kind of subtle matter that acts as an interface for the ear consciousness to hear sounds. That is a subtle matter. What is it in the ear? There's a kind of a little thing like a drum, and within that there's some little cilia that actually experience the pressure and so forth. It's within those that the subtle ear faculty exists. Similar for the nose, there's a subtle kind of matter called the nose faculty that acts as the interface between nose consciousness and odors or fragrances. Same thing in the tongue. Certain regions of the tongue have certain subtle factors that can experience sweet, sour, bitter, salty, you know, astringent, and so forth. And the body faculty pervades the entire body and experiences physical things, physical pleasure, pain, heat and cold, and so forth. So the six faculties, although they appear intellectually and to visually, they can't be seen with the eye because they're subtle matter, but if you were to imagine them, they do not exist inherently the way that they appear to the mind. No, so there's no eye, means no eye faculty, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Mental faculty doesn't mean the brain, right? A lot of Westerners would tell you that's the mental organ. From a Buddhist understanding, that's not the mental organ. The mental organ is a previous moment of consciousness that can evolve into the next moment of of consciousness. No, I know, so we say, Mikme, Naome, Name, Cheme, Lume, Yime, when monks recite. Then further, there's no visual form that is the objects of eye consciousness. There are no sounds, no inherently existent sound, which is an object of ear consciousness, no odors corresponding to the nose faculty, right? No tastes that are objects of the tongue consciousness, no objects of touch, tactile, which are objects of the body consciousness, and no phenomena, which means the category, say, for instance, the mental consciousness. Each of the five gross physical senses have their own specific objects. Do eyes hear sounds? No. They don't taste. They don't smell. They don't perceive odors. They don't taste tastes. They don't, the eye faculty in general, its specific characteristic is not to feel hot and cold and so forth. The eye consciousness, the eye faculty only acts as an interface to experience shapes and colors, visual form, in other words. Each of the five faculties, physical faculties, have their own specific objects, but the mental consciousness can experience all of them. When we talk about yet the mental consciousness has its own specific object, although it can perceive through knowing what the eye consciousness is experiencing. The mental consciousness can experience forms. It can experience sounds by knowing what the ear consciousness is experiencing and so forth. Yet the mental consciousness has its own specific set of objects, which are called dharma, phenomena. That means the things that are exclusive to the mental consciousness. What does it experience that the other physical consciousnesses don't experience? Well, it can know emptiness. It can know impermanence. It can, does the eye consciousness see impermanence? Perceive impermanence? Well, you might say, as I was standing there, I saw the car crash, like in slow motion, and I saw it change. So therefore, my eye consciousness saw impermanence. Well, there's a difference. Impermanence appears to all the consciousnesses, but it is not cognized by the eye consciousness or the ear consciousness, nose, tongue, or body consciousness. It's not known by them. It appears, but it's not apprehended. So impermanence, emptiness, and other phenomena like that are only known by the mental consciousness. Okay, those are called phenomena. None of those objects of the senses exist inherently. So in the state of meditating on emptiness, if you were to have been meditating on visual forms, once you realize their emptiness, in emptiness there is no visual form. In emptiness there is no sound. So say in emptiness there's no visual form. That would imply, in answer, I think, to Barbara or whoever asked before, there's no color. Because the objects of visual form, the visual consciousness, are shapes and colors. So in emptiness, in the state of directly realizing emptiness, there are no shapes and colors. There's no visual form. So that it's not as though it looks a little bit white or blue or something like this. It's something that is known by the mental consciousness, just the mere lack of that. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no mind, there is no I element. Here's a translated kam or dhatu, the Sanskrit word dhatu. Have you heard of dhatu before? Like there's a, I think some of Trogyen Trungpa's centers were called Dharma Dhatu. Dharma Dhatu explain in a second. So generally the Buddha explained all impermanent phenomena can be included in five aggregates. Excuse me. All impermanent phenomena are either forms, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, or consciousness. There is no impermanent phenomena that can't be included in one of those. So the grab bag is compositional factors. So that includes things that are impermanent, such as aging and other kinds of things like this. The person, like the person, who can I choose here? Hemant. Hemant is a person, right? There, and is Hemant permanent? Maybe Patty would say yes.
No.
The person is impermanent. Is the person form, the form aggregate? No. Is person feeling? We might associate with feeling. Sometimes the person is not feeling. Is the person, what's this one? Discrimination? No. Is the person primary consciousness? No. The person is impermanent. It's none of those other four, so it's included in the aggregate of compositional factors. So all impermanent phenomena are included in one of the five aggregates. Now, if you want to talk about categories of all phenomena, we talk about the 12 ayatana, which means the six faculties. Remember, we talked about the eye faculties, subtle matter, and their corresponding consciousnesses. Ayatana sometimes can say doorways or entrances. We translate them as entrances. So that after it says Shariputra, in emptiness there are none of the five aggregates. There's no form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, no consciousness. So nothing impermanent is there. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, but six faculties. No visual form. Yeah, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. So this is talking about the 12 entrances to consciousness. The interface and the objects are doorways to give rise to, entrances to give rise to consciousness. Then it says, there is no mind element and so on up to and including, there is no I element and so far and so on up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. So there's no dhatus. There are said to be 18 phenomena, which also include all phenomena, impermanent and permanent. The five aggregates only include impermanent phenomena. There's nothing permanent in the five aggregates. So if you want to have some exhaustive list of all phenomena, including permanent and impermanent phenomena, you need to choose either the 12 entrances or 12 ayatanas that was here referred to as no eye, no ear, and so forth, no visual form, no sound, and so forth. There's 12 elements, six faculties and six objects of the faculties. Also, if you add the six consciousnesses, so the eye faculty, visual form, and then what arises from that, the eye consciousness. You have six sets of three, so 18 dhatus. Here, when you talk about the dharma dhatu, what that means is the exclusive qualities of the mental consciousness, again, like emptiness and so forth. So sometimes dharma dhatu refers to, is another synonym of emptiness in the sutras. So I'll just finish this. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, or what said, no death with or without aging, and no extinction of aging and death. What is this talking about? When it says up to, it's talking about the list of the 12 links of dependent origination, right? Starting with ignorance, as Jennifer quoted off very, very well, ignorance is a condition that gives rise to karmic formations. Karmic formations leave an imprint in consciousness, which then can, when it ripens, give rise to name and form, so fertilized egg and so forth, the 12 links. That's called the contaminated 12 links. The uncontaminated 12 links means the extinction, you know, by ceasing or causing the extinction of ignorance, there will be no more karmic formations. Extinction. There is trying to see the Tibetan word here. Yes, sepa. Sepa, the Tibetan word sepa means extinction, you know, ceasing. So if you cease ignorance, you'll cease karmic formations. If karmic formations are ceased, there will be the ceasing of implanting karmic seeds in the consciousness and so forth. So that's talking about the pure forward direction of the 12 links. There's also what's called the reverse order of the 12 links, both contaminated and uncontaminated version. Here it doesn't go into all of those. So this is talking about, you know, emptiness, in emptiness, the meditation on emptiness, direct realization of emptiness, let's say. Even a conceptual, correct realization of emptiness, not necessarily a direct realization, even a conceptual realization, other than the fact that emptiness is appearing to you as inherently existent, there are no forms. There are none of the five aggregates. There are none of the 12 entrances. There are none of the 18 dhatus or elements. There are none of the 12 links or extinction of the 12 links. And finally, similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. Maybe you could say or path. So what are those? The Four Noble Truths. Not truths. So in the meditation on emptiness, whether it be direct or inferential, that is to say through conceptual means, even though you might have meditated on the emptiness of the truth of suffering, the emptiness of the truth of the origin of suffering and so forth, once you realize their emptiness, the conventional phenomena no longer appear to your mind. So an emptiness, that's why it's called space-like meditation on emptiness. Only thing that's appearing is emptiness. There is no gnosis, or translated exalted wisdom. That is the for instance, what is realizing the emptiness? It's this special kind of wisdom. We could call gnosis here. It's about to say yeshe. Yeshe me. No, there's no, like lame yeshe, right? In Sanskrit, you know the Sanskrit? Jnana. Like, when you say lame yeshe's name mantra, we say shatsana muni jnana. Jnana means gnosis or exalted wisdom, yeshe. There is no exalted wisdom, there is no attainment, and no non-attainment. So one might think in meditation, before you enter in, you're meditating on the fact, I will attain realization of emptiness. And as an antidote to that anticipation, you meditate on the emptiness of that. To the mind that realizes the emptiness of attainment, attainment doesn't appear. All that appears is emptiness. No, not, and, you know, if you're frustrated, you haven't realized yet emptiness as may become an impediment to your practice. So you meditate on the emptiness of non-attainment. Non-attainment doesn't exist inherently. It can, you know, not only can it change, but it doesn't appear the way that it does to the mind, that it seems to appear to the mind, that, oh, I'm just inferior, I can't achieve these things. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation of path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Should I do the rest later? Yeah. So although there's a little following sentence here, let me read the Tibetan of that section so that you can say, oh, I did receive the oral transmission somehow. So where did we start? Right here. Yeah. What do we say? Suk tongbao, tongbani sukso, suk le tongbani shenmayen, tongbani le kyan, suk shenmayeno. So form is empty, emptiness is form, form is not other than emptiness is not other than form. Dejendu, similarly, sorwa dang, duche dang, duche dang, napa shepa nam tongbao. Similarly, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness are empty. Shariputra, pay attention. Detar, chutamche tongvanite, seni mepa, makepa, magakpa, dima mepa, dima dang dewa, tiwa mepa, kangwa mepa o. So, Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are empty, without characteristics, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, devoid of stain, not diminished, not fulfilled. Shariputra, Shariput, Detar, Detawena, therefore, tongpanila in emptiness, sukme, no form, sorwa me, duche me, duche nam me. There's no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, the five aggregates. Napa shepa me, no consciousness, five aggregates. Mikme, nawa me, name, che me, lu me, yi me. There's no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, meaning the faculties. Sukme, no visual form. Sukme, dame, dime, rome, Rechame, chomedo. There are no objects of those five of the six senses. Mikikame, ne. Ikikame. Mikikame, ne. Ikikame. So there is no I consciousness. There's no I element in emptiness up to no mental element. Iki, iki napa shepe kamgi badu yang medo. Marikpa me, marikpa sepa me. Sepa me. Marikpa sepa mepa ne. Gashi me. Gashi sepe badu yang medo. So there is none of that. There is no forward 12 links starting from ignorance up to including gashi means aging and death, or death with, without aging. Deshindu dukna wadang, kungjong wadang, gokpadang, lame, yesheme, topame, matopayang medo. So likewise, there's no suffering, no origin, no origin, no cessation, and no path, no exalted wisdom, no gnosis, no attainment, and no non-attainment. So all this in emptiness, no conventional phenomena appear, even though they may have been the object that you were analyzing the emptiness of, or even if they weren't the object you were meditating on the emptiness, none of them appear. All that appears is emptiness. Okay, so we've got close to four, started at one. Now, you have, if you have some question about this, of course you could ask tomorrow. You might say, I don't know, I got my question right. If you have a question now, you're welcome to ask. I think Robbie's cooking. He's gone off. Make sure that the turkey hasn't burnt. What did we make one time, Robbie? You taught me how to make with eggplant and tomatoes and what was that called? Ratatouille.
Mm-hmm.
Ratatouille, right?
Exactly. Yes.
He has great. If you ever want to find the right way to make ratatouille, check with Robbie. Anyway, so questions about this?
I've given you the transmission on the ratatouille, George, so they can ask you.
Yeah, okay, I've received the oral transmission. I've tried it, yeah. That method is really good. You have to desiccate the things, first of all, in the oven before you mix them together and everything. So it's a long process. Okay, no questions right now. I'm sure if you think about Laura.
I do. I'm confused with the form. When you talked about a person falling under the aggregate of the compositional factors.
Right.
But then there's the person in form.
Come again?
That falls under form.
Aggregate. No, there's not a person that falls under form.
There isn't. That's where I'm confused.
Yeah. So if I see your form, one can say that I see Laura, but it's a little bit play here. How do you perceive the person? Because the person is only imputed upon the five aggregates, one of which is form. Feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness. The person, Laura, is the conventionally existent phenomena that is merely imputed on the five aggregates. So the person is not form, yet seeing one of the aggregates that you are familiar with, say I see Laura in the distance, in the shopping mall or something, I could say, I saw Laura. or if I hear your voice, which I've become familiar with on the phone or calling me across the room, I say, I heard Laura. But Laura is not your speech, but it will suffice by perceiving that to say that I heard Laura. So the Laura's form is not Laura, but by seeing the form, I can say that I, colloquially or conventionally, I can say I saw Laura, but Laura herself is the self of Laura is, or the person Laura is just an invitation on the five aggregates, which are diverse. Like say, for instance, if I say I see a flower, that's completely legitimate because flower generally we say is an object of eyesight. Although it does have odor, the predominant thing that the logicians categorized flower as is its shape and color, okay? Although it has odor and has a, you know, it has a tactile sensation to it and so forth. It has a taste, saffron and so forth. Generally though, because the person is imputed on this diverse category, diverse collection of parts, some of which are physical, some of which are mental, the person is not the mind. The person is not the form. The person is just a non-associated compositional factor that is imputed upon the five aggregates. That's why it's not in the form aggregate, because it's not imputed only on form. It's imputed on the collection of the five aggregates, one of which is form. Does that help?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much.
Naga, I think you had at the same time you had a question.
So much I go back to mental health.
To mental what?
Because you speak about the unconscious people who can hear. I don't know if I can explain well, but there are people who can see Holy spirits or spirits or hear voices, mental health. But when you're speaking all this, it kind of can relate people who are enlightened probably, or the people who can see them, or what do you think about that in relation to emptiness?
So Buddhism believes that there are definitely other realms other than the human and animal realms. There's a realm of what we might call hungry ghosts, spirits that are suffering a lot, and hell beings that we don't generally perceive. With a certain kind of clairvoyance, one can actually perceive them. I think Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who has accumulated so much merit through his practice and also through his development of wisdom and so forth, when he sits outside at night, he can sometimes see the flames of the hungry ghosts that themselves, their bodies are engulfed in flames. Other beings that can actually, that have clairvoyance, that see the hell realms, can actually perceive those realms. They're not objects that occur to our ordinary eye. They occur to what's called the divine eye. The divine eye, remember when I was talking before, when I talked about the eye of wisdom, so when we meditate on the clear light nature of the mind, the clear light nature of the mind is not an object of ordinary eye. It's an object of the eye of wisdom. In other words, it's perceived by your mental consciousness. So in the same way, the divine eye that can perceive distant events, in a sense, see them, see the forms, see the Buddha teaching in another realm and so forth. The divine ear that can hear the teachings that are being given there, they are dependent on the mental consciousness, their kind of clairvoyance. So all of those, whether it be hungry ghosts or hell beings or the Buddha teaching in other realms, all of those things that can be perceived with higher consciousness, they too are empty of inherent existence. I mentioned at the beginning, sometimes we think, you know, we sentient beings, we're empty of inherent existence. What we'd like to do is to become Buddha. That must exist. Buddhahood, you know, how can you say that's empty? In our mind, we haven't yet realized the meaning of emptiness. Emptiness means phenomena have a conventional existence. That is to say, they appear and they can be consistently imputed as having, you know, that's a Buddha, that's an ordinary being, that's a hungry ghost, those are teachings, this is a car. They can be legitimately, validly ascertained as in this conventional sense, having these names and fulfilling certain properties, yet they are devoid of the reality that our mind attributes to them. They are mere appearances. Those appearances arise because of karma that we've created in the past and the present, both collective and individual karma that we've created. And so there's a consistency. When you wake up tomorrow, your room will still be there looking the same and so forth, because the karma has not ceased yet for you to experience that appearance. But all of those appearances are devoid of the reality, that subtle most reality that we're attributing to them that causes all our problem. They appear to be inherently existent, but they're actually devoid of that reality. They're like dreams. When you in the dream, seems so real. So you might be crying or wake up sweating for out of fear or have some, you know, how to say, emotional, how to say, embrace with someone, or, you know, physical. You may wake up in that state of ecstasy, but then you say, it was just a dream. But in that dream, it seemed so real. When you wake from the dream, you recognize it appeared to your mind. You remember the appearance, but you know, having awoken, that it didn't exist the way that it appeared. In the same way, all these phenomena are like a dream. They're not a dream, but they're like a dream in that they appear so real. And when we wake from the sleep of ignorance, when we have a realization of emptiness, we'll recognize that they didn't exist that way. That was so compelling. You know, we had so much attachment for something, so much anger for something, because we believed it really existed. When we wake from the sleep of ignorance, we'll see all of this as like a dream. It appears, there's some consistency, maybe even more consistent than the dream, because dreams don't necessarily, you don't have a continuation of dream the next time you fall asleep. Maybe some of you do. I generally can't get in the hang of it and getting the same dream. So it said that sleep yoga, if you can have a conscious awareness that you're dreaming. So when you're in the dream, through various means, Sometimes people talk about conscious dreaming. What do they call it in the world? Some people talk about that. Lucid dreaming. So if you realize that you are dreaming in the dream, this is a dream, you can marvel at how it seems so real. But if you've kept the mindfulness through the process of falling asleep, and you know that you're dreaming, that can give you an insight into how to view these ordinary events of the life. They appear so real, but they're devoid of the reality that we are attributing to them, that we are grasping to, that we're believing. And so in the same way, when you wake from the dream and you're no longer being chased by the dogs, or you didn't fail the final exam in college, you know, that you're so, you woke up, it was just a dream. You know, it's incredible relief. So when you realize emptiness, it said, all fears, all worries, all regrets, you know, that you're holding so inherently can be dissipated. Doesn't mean that you don't still regret negative actions you've done because they've left imprints in your mind. You can still regret them because they will cause appearances in the future. But those appearances don't have an inherent existence. Okay. That's a good place to stop, I think. So thank you very much. Let's do a quick dedication. I should say brief, as in quick. Sit comfortably. Recognize the clear light nature of your mind. Recognize that this afternoon, yesterday, and hopefully tomorrow we have and are and will accumulate virtuous merit to the infallible law of cause and effect. The virtues that we create will definitely ripen as something pleasurable within cyclic existence. Or at least in the case of rebirth in the higher realms, rebirth, which is called the maturation effect, is not necessarily pleasure or none or suffering, but you know, states that are what we call high upper realms or lower realms. The virtue that we've created will ripen in these ways, definitely. But to prevent them ripening once and being dissipated, we dedicate this merit to the distant goal of our continued realizations, development of realizations, compassion, renunciation, realization of emptiness, up to and including enlightenment. How wonderful that would be if these merits ripened as a reservoir of causes that impel my realizations from life to life, up to and including enlightenment, when I myself, with the omniscient mind, will have achieved my own aim, perfect happiness, and I can spontaneously and effortlessly enact the welfare of all sentient beings, leading them out of suffering into the bliss of enlightenment. That's how these merits should ripen. I'm dedicating them in that way. And having made a conventional dedication like that, seal that dedication in the emptiness of the three spheres, which means recognizing the agent, myself, the object object dedicated to the enlightenment and so forth, realizations, and the process, the action of dedicating, all are empty of inherent existence, making them like a rainbow. They appear, they're empty of the existence that we often attribute to them, inherent existence, yet they still, that doesn't negate the fact that they're empty of inherent existence, doesn't negate the fact that they appear and will function, that we can attain enlightenment. Thank you very much. So we'll try again tomorrow, finish the Heart Sutra, and have a good night. If you go to the deli, you can get some ratatouille and be envious of the recipe that Robbie passed on. Anyway, take care.
Thank you,
Venerable George. Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Venerable George.
Thank you to the center.
Have a good evening.
You too.
Good evening,
Venerable George and Donna.